Welcome to the Aquarium Max audio show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 116, recorded June 4th, 2012.
Greetings, everyone.
Hello again. Today, we will be hearing from Tony in New York and Anne in Pittsburgh.
And Stop Fighting Five, sort of. I'll explain more about that later.
I don't know what that means.
It's a YouTube ID, not a real name.
Oh, so we heard from someone on YouTube.
Yeah.
Okay, because I haven't been fighting five of anything.
Me neither.
We only have four kids.
Okay.
Okay, so Tony wanted to talk about his cycling issues that he's been having.
Yes. As many of you may know, if you've been following along, you do know that Tony has been cycling some tanks. 20-gallon, as I recall, and a 1-gallon. And he had been very patient, glacially patient, admirably patient, waiting for this tank to cycle, but it had
been wasn't anything going
over
on.
40 days and 40 nights. It had been a long time, and it wasn't really doing what he was hoping.
You should have stuck it in an arc.
There you go. Hoping that something would happen, but during these past 2 weeks, since we didn't have a normal podcast last time, we had an interview podcast, we didn't talk about this, because we talked about mouth-breeding betas last week. So, there wasn't an update last week about this, but that you heard, but Tony has been updating me, and it's been cool. His first message said that his ammonia had dropped by 1 part per million over the last 2 days, no nitrites yet, and then he fed a little bit more ammonia to avoid depleting the food source, and then the ammonia soon after that. And this was in the 1 gallon tank, interestingly enough, where the nitrite showed up first. So his test showed up purple, so he was getting a nitrite reading. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't any on the main tank yet, but the ammonia levels were dropping. And he took some gravel from the 1 gallon tank and dropped it in the main tank just in case, to see, you know, it might help. And I said, well, if the ammonia levels are dropping, it can't be too far behind on the main tank. And I probably would have moved some gravel too. And then shortly thereafter, I think a day after that, he said he conducted new tests and now showing nitrites on the 20-gallon as well as the 1-gallon.
So good.
And I love this. He said, I've never been so excited to see purple. Here's a toast to my brave new bacteria. Ammonia all around. Here, here. And then soon after that, nitrates were showing up. I think it was several days thereafter, but nitrates began to show up. And so now the process is working. This, you know, there are a lot of cool things about this. One thing is that I've already mentioned is that Tony's been so patient, because this has taken longer than it usually does.
It's been a very long time.
One thing that he mentioned that could be a factor is the warming temperatures, because, you know, bacteria do cycle faster at warmer temperatures, and his temperatures have been
colder when he started.
Quite a bit cooler, because he doesn't have a heater in the tanks.
Mm.
And so that is one possible factor, but it's working. And another factor that I think is great, something that is that Tony has documented all of this. And there is an internet rumor, I guess you could say, that it's impossible to cycle tanks under, and they give you a number, like under 3 gallons or whatever.
Why would that be, though? It's still water. It's still got stuff in it.
Right. Now, it is, I would agree that it's more difficult, and I've said it before on the podcast.
Just because it's harder to keep a balance when there's a smaller amount?
Yeah, it's harder to do a lot of things in a smaller tank, but it's not impossible, and here is documented evidence of that, which I think is great that Tony has done that. He cycled a 1-gallon tank, and he cycled a 20-gallon at about the same time. Mm-hmm. Not exactly. They've been off a little bit time-wise, but it's worked.
Well, my question for the theory that you can't cycle a small tank, how do they think that small tanks keep working then?
Well, it is very possible to maintain a tank without any particular attention towards cycling if it's small, just by water change.
Okay.
So and you can do that. And people do that with bettas, for example, a lot. You can. The thing is, though, it's gone from it's difficult to cycle a small tank to it's impossible. And internet,
well, it's obviously not, you know, impossible.
Right. And that's one of the beauties of what Tony has done, has demonstrated that. But there may be other examples of it happening like that. But the problem is so many people circulate those ideas without actually
researching anything.
Researching it and saying it's impossible. So there you go. So thank you, Tony. That's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And Tony goes on with a different topic as well. And congratulations, by the way, Tony, on your recent cycling. I think it's very cool.
Very, very cool. Well, he says he really enjoyed the interview with Mick, as did we, of course, on the mouth-brooding betas. He says, very good information and very inspiring.
It was. It was a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. And thank you again, Mick, for doing that with us.
Yeah, that was fun.
And I think, I don't know if I got it in here. I must have made a mistake when I was cutting and pasting things into my notes. But he mentioned that this interview kind of inspired his wife into thinking she might get mouth-brooding betas sometime.
Oh.
Because she's been looking into betas, but this kind of new slant on a beta mm-hmm. she hadn't really heard of, I guess, before, mm-hmm. Is very interesting to her.
Oh, so there you go.
Tony and his wife had a discussion about it that this podcast with Mick had inspired.
Well, cool.
That was cool.
He has another question, and he says, would you speak a little on best practices when receiving new plants? I've heard about giving them a dip, an alum, saltwater, bleach, potassium permanganate. Did I say that right?
There's a lot of people who pronounce it that way. That's how I pronounce it, permanganate.
Okay. And I vaguely read that quarantine is a good idea, too, but details seem to conflict regarding the details.
They do indeed. There are so many so many different ideas about how this works out there. And so he also adds, do you have any ideas regarding best practices when getting ready to acclimate a plant to a new environment? So those are related, but not exactly the same question. So we'll hit the first one first. When you're receiving new plants, how do you clean them up, basically? And there are a couple of different options. I'll tell you a couple of things. First of all, plant treatment with potassium permanganate. I'm going to put a link on the show page to that.
Okay.
To talk about it. It is a chemical that is used for all sorts of things. It can be used to clean out certain types of water softeners.
Mm-hmm.
It can be used medically as a kind of a disinfectant. It's used for all sorts of different things. In aquariums, it is used to kill nasties of various sorts.
So, like parasites or anything that might be hitchhiking on the plants?
Yeah.
But it doesn't hurt the plant?
Well, it can if you use too much of it and things like that. It can also be used to kill parasites and things like that. It has been used in the past to treat fish diseases as a prophylactic. It's been used mm-hmm. as all kinds of things. The issue about this stuff, if you read the material safety data sheet on it,
mm-hmm.
it's kind of scary. It's pretty strong, and it can cause...
Like, don't get it on your skin, wear goggles kind of
stuff. It's pretty dangerous. I mean, it depends on the concentration, too. I mean, you can have a pretty safe concentration. If there are aquarium products, the principal ingredients of which are potassium permanganate in water, and they're not mm-hmm. as dangerous as, you know, if you get a more... a higher concentration solution or a powder or whatever. But it's not the safest thing in the world. It works by oxidation, so kind of like bleach, not quite as powerful as bleach maybe in the concentrations we usually use it in, but still kind of the same idea as bleach.
Okay.
So, I mean, they used to dip goldfish in it and stuff. There's a good article, the one I'm going to include.
Doesn't sound very comfortable.
Well, they used to do it as a prophylactic, you know, a treatment of general things. They weren't sure what might be wrong or if anything was wrong yet, but they wanted to make sure nothing got wrong, so they would dip them in it.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is...
Did it not kill them?
Oh, it often did. They would die later from gill damage.
Oh.
It's kind of like chlorine in its effects in a lot of ways, so you have to be careful with it.
That doesn't sound very fun.
It's a little safer for plants than it is for fish. I mean, you can put a dose that kills buggies and nasties on plants,
mm-hmm.
and then if you were to use that same concentration on fish, it would kill them. So you just have to be careful with it, but I'll just tell you, I actually haven't used it much. I've researched it so I can know what it is a little bit, but I haven't really done a whole lot with it. I haven't done anything with it, I should say.
Because it sounds scary. We don't like to use scary things.
But some people swear by it as a dip, and because I haven't used it as a dip on plants, I'm not going to talk a whole lot about it, except to say read the article in the Skeptical Aquarist about it, and that's on the show page, the link, for those of you who are interested in using that. Okay. Now... the next one we're going to talk about is bleach dips for plants. This one I have done, only as a last resort and only a couple of times, and the last time I did it was probably 7 or 8 years ago. I don't know, it was a good while. I haven't had to resort to it since then. The only plants I've used it for was Anubias,
mm-hmm.
because at the time I was still figuring out how to grow Anubias effectively without getting algae growth, and mm-hmm. so at the time I had several... leaves that were pretty much coated with algae, or not coated, but they had a lot of algae around the edges of the leaves, and it looked really bad, and I was sick of it, and was trying to deal with it, having some issues with it. So I did a bleach dip. It was about one part bleach to 20 parts water. And I dipped the leaves and the petioles, the stems of the leaves, basically, mm-hmm. into this bleach solution for, I can't remember the exact time. I'd have to look that up. But it wasn't very long. It was probably like 20 seconds.
Okay.
And then I dipped them in dechlorinated water, rinsed them off really mm-hmm. well before I did anything, before I put them in the tank. A lot of times you can make a rinse water that is a high quantity of dechlorinator, extra dechlorinator in it, to make sure you take care of it.
Really get rid of it.
Right.
Now, why does it kill the bleach and not the other plant? Why does it kill the bleach. Why does it kill the algae, not the other plant?
Well, that's a great question. Okay, well, the idea behind that is that algae is really a different beast. It's not really a plant.
Oh, what is it?
No, it's a protist, basically, depending on which taxonomy you ascribe to, I guess. But, yeah, that's the latest one that I've heard. It's considered a protist, which is sort of a catch-all category that includes all sorts of tiny, swimmy creatures. It includes kelp, and it includes the microalgae that you're likely to find in a freshwater aquarium.
So it's kind of the big miscellaneous box.
In a way, it is. And as such, it doesn't have the microalgae you're likely to find in a freshwater aquarium, the one that was afflicting my Anubias, doesn't have a cuticle
to protect it. Like on my fingernails?
That, like the one that Anubias does.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Anubias has a protective layer and the algae doesn't.
Right. Algae has a protective layer of sorts, but it's not anywhere near as thick or as resilient as that on Anubias.
It's got a leather jacket, and the Anubias has chainmail.
Something like that, yeah. So the Anubias is much better equipped to handle a very hostile environment like the bleach in the water. Yeah. And so that's basically how that works. You know, be careful with bleach, too. It's not the safest thing to be messing with. Right. I remember the first time I did it, I got a drop on my shorts and ate a hole in my shorts eventually. The shorts turned white in that spot, and then the fabric kind of died out there. Yeah. Of course, so use all these products at your own risk, both the potassium permanganate and the bleach. Be careful. Read material, safety data sheets on it, all that, and take appropriate precautions. And we, of course, absolve ourselves of any responsibility relating to your use of such products.
Though we wish you well.
Yeah. Good luck. The next product is
alum.
Alum's a little safer. Not to say you shouldn't be careful with it and take appropriate precautions with it, because you know you get it in your eyes, it still stings. Mm-hmm. But it is an astringent used in making
pickles.
Yeah, and so you know that's a little safer. Nobody puts bleach in their pickles. At least I hope not.
I hope not. But wouldn't be very tasty pickles.
No, but alum is it's a food grade ingredient. Mm-hmm. You know, and you can find it in the spice rack at the store, usually.
Yep.
And if you could make a solution of that and dip your plants in it to remove hitchhikers. See, and this is, I think, most of what Tony's question was.
Can you put the roots in an alum solution, too?
You can. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Maybe you wouldn't want to in the bleach solution, though.
Right, the bleach solution would be a little stronger, so I wouldn't necessarily advocate doing that. At least I never have. Some people have done that with some plants. But yeah, that could be... hopefully that gives little guidelines on how those two work. And then the next one is alum. Alum is... I forgot. Did I give the ratio for bleach? About one part bleach to 20 parts water? I don't remember if I did that or not, but hopefully I did. Anyway, I'm getting all messed up here, so we'll talk about alum now. Alum is used for making pickles, among other things, so it's a little safer, maybe, than some of the others. Still be careful with it, of course, but it is often used to keep hitchhikers off of plants, or rather, to as a dip, to prevent hitchhikers from getting from the plants to the new tank that you're putting them in. You do it separately. You don't put it in the tank, but you do a dip in a basin or other container before. A lot of different recipes in terms of concentration. I've seen recipes, I think the most common recipe that I've seen is about 1 teaspoon per gallon, but I've seen as many as 10 recommended. And that tends to indicate to me that there's probably a wide variety of possible dosages that are useful without being lethal. That would be my guess. Some people do salt water too, but I haven't really done that a whole lot. And some plants can't really tolerate it, so if you're going to look at salt water dips, I'd suggest do a little research on that and find out whether your particular plant species is salt tolerant or not. Anubias, Java fern, Java moss tend to be a little salt tolerant and can actually be grown in brackish water if they're acclimated to it and it's not too strong. So, you know, those might be fine, but there are others, right, others that might not be.
Okay. And before we go any further, let's try and take a break.
Hello, this is Ken Jones of the Prince of Ponds and Pet Tech Podcasts, and you're listening to one of my favorites, the Aquarimax Show.
Now, there are more ways than ever to be a part of Aquarimax. In addition to downloading the podcast on iTunes, you can follow us on Twitter, like our Facebook page, subscribe to our YouTube channel, or call us anytime and leave a phone message at 801-477-0629, or just email us at info@aquarimax.com. And now, back to the Aquarimax Audio Show, the podcast with Icy Nug. Yay, we were successful at taking a break. We did it. We missed the barn.
Yeah. Okay, so Tony's next idea was about quarantine. He was wondering about, acclimation, actually, not so much quarantine. Acclimating plants to a new environment. And this one's a little bit of a trickier thing to deal with, I guess, because in terms of explaining that, I think plants tend to be a little bit more forgiving in terms of being able to place them in a tank with different pH and different, water parameters, so to speak, that might be hard for fish or invertebrates to take. But since you can take a plant and just ship it damp in a bag, and it can be fine for several days at least, even some of the plants that are not very hardy can do that. You could not do that with most fish, right? So,
right.
They tend to be more hardy that way, although a lot of them take a while to adapt to the conditions in terms of being able to start some vigorous growth. So I often see people say that many plants can take up to 2 weeks before they start really vigorously growing once they get into a new setup, and I think it varies on the plant. Some of them are much faster than that.
The setup they're coming from and the setup they're going into.
Right. How different the conditions are, what the water parameters are like, and so on. But I've seen plants after a couple of days, they just go to town, and you can see it. And others that really do, you plant them, and it takes a couple of weeks before they start actually getting down to business of growing. I think in some cases, like heavy-rooted plants might be sending out roots before they do a whole lot of leaf growth. And
so they are like being active, we just can't see it
in
yet.
Some cases, yeah. And in some cases, I've heard that plants don't really start taking nutrients from the water in a new situation until they've had some chance to acclimate. But other than that, I'd say there's not so much to worry about. I myself don't keep a whole lot of really delicate plants. I usually keep the toughies. Because that's what I have time for, and that's what works easily. So I've kept a number of species, but most of them are just tough ones, so I haven't had to worry about it very much. So hopefully that helps a little bit. And thank you, Tony, for your good questions, as usual.
And we are now going to hear from Anne in Pittsburgh. Now, remind us again about her project that she was talking to us about.
She was thinking about moving all everything from the substrate to the decor to the fish to a large quantity of the water from a 30-gallon planted tank and did I say the inhabitants too?
I think you did. You said fish,
okay.
I think.
Okay. And there are inverts in there too. To a 45-gallon tank.
So same kind of setup, she just wants it in a bigger tank.
Right. And on the same stand, same equipment, everything.
And we've kind of corresponded about that a couple times. We've talked about this a couple times. So she says, I really appreciated all your input into my project. So far, I have not yet attempted getting a new 45-gallon tank. I am still hoping to switch out my 30-gallon tank with all its fish and inhabitants into a 45-gallon using the same stand and equipment, but I am really glad I asked you because you guys mentioned a lot of things I had not thought of in transferring. So I feel like when I do attempt it, I'll have a much better chance at success. That's good.
Yeah, I'm glad it was helpful.
She says, the main reason I have not tried this yet is my blue rams keep spawning. They spawn, have wigglers, and free-swimming fry, and after 2 to 3 days, all the fry are gone. Makes you kind of want to sing, where have all the fry gone?
Well, it didn't make me want to sing that, but that's okay.
Well, sometimes you don't want to sing, and I do, and that's okay.
I know.
They're guarding them fiercely for my community fish, fast neon tetras, emerald dwarf resboras, blue rice fish, endlers, and slow honey gold grammys and shrimp. They also do a great job at picking up stray fry in their mouths and bringing them back to the ball of swimming fry. I've been feeding them Hikari first bites and an eyedropper after they start swimming about 1 to 2 times per day. When I talked to my local fish store, they thought that maybe because of all the community fish, the rams are getting tired and giving up after a while, then eating the fry to cut their losses and try another spawn later. This has happened about 4 or 5 times since January. I got a fish tank divider this time, and I'm thinking of putting it in to see if that is the issue. Do you or your listeners have any ideas on how I can keep the fry alive?
Okay, well, a couple of things. I should mention one thing that Anne sent a really nice picture.
Oh, it was gorgeous.
Yeah, of the portion of her tank where the rams are.
Do we have that up yet, or we will
have put it
up
on the show page. Okay. Yeah, it's a great picture. It's got the planted tank, not the whole tank, but you see a section of the planted tank, and in the center of the shot, you see the two ram parents surrounded by this cloud of fry. It's sort of a great shot
in terms of being framed really nicely.
Yeah, the framing, the composition, everything is really nice.
It's a really cool picture.
Yeah, so thanks for sending that in. And I would say the divider is a good idea because it is common for cichlids to decide, like you say, cut their losses. They just want to keep the protein in the family. They figure that they've put so much effort into this, and they're going to lose the batch because all these other fish are picking at their fry, so they're just going to eat it and try for better conditions next time, which they don't always get. And it sounds like that may be what's happening. So a divider may be enough to solve the problem.
That's a good idea. Hopefully it works.
And another thing that I would suggest as well is that in my experience using prepared foods for fry, it doesn't necessarily work as well. Not saying that anything about particular brands or anything. I'm just saying that I've noticed with cichlid fry and other fry, if I use some live food, they tend to do better.
What kind of live food?
That's my experience. But with ram fry, I would start out with something like Walter worms or micro worms. And baby brine shrimp could work too. Probably rams are not super huge for fry. They're pretty small, but they're cichlid fry. You know, they're a lot bigger than a lot of other fish. Maybe the San Francisco strain of brine shrimp. Not
but
sure.
Do they tend to be smaller?
They are smaller than the Salt Lake ones, yeah. But I would certainly try microworms or Walter worms because in a given sample of Walter worms or microworms, you have some that are a lot smaller because they're younger.
Yeah, that's true.
And so you'll have some in there that they can eat at least. And then once they get that in their bellies, they'll start growing fast until they're big enough to eat more. And you can also enrich the diet of, you know, those worms pretty easily, boost their protein content and so on, just by what you give them in their culture medium. So I would say to try that if you can, target feed like you are with some of that as well. Not say you shouldn't use the Hikari first bites. Try those as well, but you know, mix it up, mix the live food into there, and with mbunas and cribs and convict cichlids, you know, that I've bred, that's what I've found that the worms make a difference. If I just try to use dry or if I mix the worms in, the worms make a positive difference. So that could help if the fry are disappearing because they're just not getting enough food of the right type fast enough. So, two ideas. Listeners, please, if you have ideas, if you've raised rams before or even similar cichlids before and you have some ideas that could be of use to Anne, please send them along in whatever form you would like. If you want to leave an audio message by calling the number, if you want to leave a Facebook comment or email, whatever, just that would be great. Mm-hmm. So thank you, Anne, and hopefully that'll help.
Yeah. Okay, so what is the Stop Fighting Five?
Okay, well, we have a contributor who I don't even know if Stop Fighting Five listens to the show or not. Just she responded to our video on how African dwarf frogs, albino ones, do exist, and how they can be distinguished from African clawed frogs, the much bigger.
Okay, so creatures. Stop Fighting 5 is a YouTube ID?
It's a YouTube ID. And she responded to that video with her own video.
I see. And what was her video?
And it was about her albino dwarf frog, Piglet.
Piglet.
But this is the coolest thing.
Oh. Okay?
I love it because what she's done is devised a method to keep African dwarf frogs well-fed in a community tank. That's a pretty cool method.
How does she do that?
I just want to tell you about it. She gets a brine shrimp net, which is white and very visible,
mm-hmm.
and she has taught the frog to associate the appearance of the net with food. No doubt she placed food into the net and lowered it into the tank, and the frog
had his own little cave to come eat in.
Something like that. I imagine it was something like that. And then now, when she puts the net into the tank, the frog approaches it, and she's got it right on video. She uh-huh. sticks the net in, and you see the frog start swimming over towards the net. And then she just scoops him up gently, and he's perfectly happy to do that because he knows what's coming.
Not out of the water. He's just kind of floating on the top so the fish can't get in.
No, she scoots him, she takes him from the bottom of the tank up towards the top.
Uh-huh.
And then he's enclosed in the net with right. the top of the net is out of the water, but the rest of the net's in the water.
It's still in the water. Right. Okay.
And then she drops some bloodworms in there, and he pigs out. And then she releases him. So.
That's pretty cool. He has like his own little food elevator.
Right, and it works very well for making sure that he gets enough food, because she can do that whenever she wants to feed the frog.
Mm-hmm.
And then he is happy and healthy, even though he's in this tank full of voracious tetras.
So that would be a good idea to do, like, if you wanted to keep a beta in with your African dwarf frogs at work.
Indeed it would. That would be a great way to do that. So I'm hoping that we can try that, or maybe something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I think it's a great idea because it's hard to keep African clawed frogs with fish in many cases just because they are outcompeted for food. That's, yeah, exactly.
Well, you probably couldn't African keep the clawed frogs with fish either because he'd just eat them.
Right, an entirely different reason.
Yeah.
Because they become the food. But great method. So thank you, Stop Fighting
and
Five,
are we
whoever you are.
Put that, the mysterious Stop Five is right out. Are we going to put that on the show page?
Yes,
we are. Going to embed that video on the show page?
We will. We'll okay. embed it on the show page if we're allowed to do that. If not, we'll just put a link to it. But either way, it'll be there.
Excellent.
And you can check it out. So, thank you to Tony and Ann and Stop Fighting Five.
I think we should call it the Mysterious Stop.
Terribly Mysterious.
Terribly Mysterious.
So, yes. And we would like to say that we hope that the fish
will be
with you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.